It's your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC for 20 great years has the best OTR on our live streaming. And continue tuning in to the Radio Book Channel, along with the RTC Music Channel, all at oldtimeradiolisten.com.
Hello and welcome to the weekly download. I'm your host, Jim Dolan. Favorite Story was a syndicated program, and it was hosted by Ronald Coleman. It featured adaptations of classics. Classics were selected by famous people of the time. In today's example, we have The Lost Horizon, and this is from 1948.
This is Ronald Coleman, inviting you to radio's most dramatic half hour, Favorite Story. One of the great ladies of motion pictures chose this week's favorite story, Miss Mary Pickford. It is the memorable Lost Horizon by James Hilton. I've made the journey to Shangri-La many times, on the air, on the screen, and on a record album. And once again, I invite you to join with me as Hugh Conway in adventuring to the remote and beautiful Valley of the Blue Moon.
You are now deep in the mountains of Tibet, the highest part of the Earth's surface. That snow-capped peak above you is Karakal, and below, in the Valley of the Blue Moon, lies the Lamasery of Shangri-La.
It was a strange and incredible sight. A group of colored pavilions clinging to the mountainside, like flower petals impaled upon a crag. Overhead, a dazzling pyramid of snow, beautiful, terrifying. From the stormy cliffs on which we stood to the serene peace and quiet of Shangri-La was like a descent into another world. I came to this world across the mountains from India. We had been flying from Baskul to Peshawar on the northwest frontier. I was the British consul in Baskul, and my vice consul, a young fellow named Mallinson, was making the trip with me. Besides us, there were a few other passengers and the pilot. Our plane should have landed in Peshawar at about 5:30. We never arrived at our destination.
Conway. I say, Conway, are you asleep?
What was that? What's the matter, Mallinson? Anything wrong?
I'm not sure. I think our pilot's off his course.
Off his course? Nonsense.
No. Look down there. Nothing but mountains as far as you can see.
I don't recognize this part of the world at all. Yes, I should say you were right, Mallinson. The man's lost his way.
What's that, Conway? Did you say we were lost?
Lost, good heavens.
No, it's quite all right, everyone. There's nothing to be upset about, I'm sure.
Well, still, there's nothing like finding out, is there? Look, shall I speak to the pilot, Conway?
No, don't bother. I'll do it. You there, pilot. Open the panel. Open up. I want to speak to you.
I advise that you ask no questions, please.
Oh. Certainly.
Now, look here. We want to know where we are.
I advise that you be seated.
I will not be seated. I want to...
Mallinson, I don't know whether you've noticed it, but there's a revolver pointed directly at my chest. Under the circumstances, I think you'd better do as the gentleman suggests. For hours after that, we sat in the darkness of the plane, each of us pretending to sleep. Suddenly, the plane lurched sharply. There was a loud rushing sound in my ears, and I realized that we were coming down.
but fast, much too fast.
We stumbled from the plane, badly shaken but uninjured. The cold was intense, a solid icy cold that you could touch with your fingertips. I knew we must be somewhere in Tibet, a vast, barren region of wind-swept upland.
Conway, come here. There's something the matter with this pilot fellow. I can't get a word out of him.
I'll loosen the strap of his helmet. He's still breathing anyhow. There was little we could do for him. We watched his breathing grow more labored every hour. And as the early rays of the sun caught the summit of the mountain, the man died.
I say, Conway.
Yes?
I've just been looking at that mountain. Am I seeing things, or are those men coming toward us?
They were men. A party of a dozen or more, crawling like ants across the white face of the cliff. As they drew near, we saw they carried among them a hooded chair, and in it, a heavily robed figure. An elderly Chinese, gray-haired,
Nishihara! I am from the Lamasery of Shangri-La.
Well?
My name is Chang.
My name is Conway.
Yes, Conway. Your ship is beyond repair?
Oh, I'm afraid so. And anyway, our pilot is dead.
So, you will come to Shangri-La. It is a hazardous journey, but the only place of habitation within 1,000 miles. I insist upon acting as your guide.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you.
Of course, you know our stay won't be long. We want to return to civilization as soon as possible.
Are you so certain you are away from it?
There was a pass at about 20,000 feet, which we managed with the aid of long ropes. When we had struggled breathlessly to the top, I saw above us, shimmering in the rosy twilight, the loveliest mountain on earth.
That snow-capped peak above you is Karakal, and below, in the Valley of the Blue Moon, lies the Lamasery of Shangri-La.
I never exactly remembered how we arrived at the Lamasery. The thin air had a dream-like texture, and I was conscious of a strange sensation, half mystical, half visual, of having reached at last some place that was an end, a finality. Shangri-La, I learned, was a sort of monastery whose inhabitants ruled the natives in the valley below. Those in full lamahood numbered about 50, and their prevalent belief was in moderation, the virtue of avoiding excess of all kinds. These things I learned the first night, as I stood with Chang on the broad balcony overlooking the valley.
There is something more you would like to know, Mr. Conway?
Please. I want to know, this morning when you found us, were you setting out on a journey?
No.
Well, then you came there deliberately to intercept us. That suggests that you must have known we were coming. The interesting question is, how?
You are very clever, but not entirely correct. Therefore, I should counsel you not to worry your friends with these abstract discussions.
No, they want something more concrete. They want to know exactly how long you're going to keep us here.
There will be certain unavoidable delays.
How long?
The difficulties of the trip, obtaining the necessary porters.
No. How long? Please.
You may tell your friends a few months.
But you don't guarantee it, huh? Is that what you mean? Well, for myself, I can't say I shall mind a great deal. It's a new and interesting experience.
In time to come, you may find it even more interesting. Good night.
In the days that followed at Shangri-La, I gave myself over to a rich and growing enchantment. In the petal-colored buildings which dotted the mountain,
I recognized priceless treasures of art. Paintings and sketches, exquisite ceramics, preserved for more than 1,000 years. In the spacious library, I discovered the great literature of the present and of centuries past. One morning, I stood beside a lotus pool in an open pavilion of the lamasery. In an archway behind me, a young girl was seated at a harpsichord, a girl in Chinese dress. Her jet-black hair was drawn tightly back and braided. Her mouth was small and pink. She was like a delicately painted miniature. That was very lovely.
You are pleased.
More than pleased. Oh, my name is Hugh Conway.
They call me Lo Tsen.
Lo Tsen. And do you live below in the valley?
No. I live here.
At the lamasery?
Yes. But as yet, I have not attained the full lamahood.
You mean you are a lama?
Yes.
I'm a bit confused. I thought only men could be lamas.
They will tell you, when you have been here longer, that in the lamahood, there are no distinctions between a man and a woman.
But you're hardly more than a child.
Shall I play for you again?
Please.
Good morning.
Oh, morning, Chang.
You are pleased with Lo Tsen?
She plays beautifully.
She has studied for many, many years.
Well, how could she? How old is Lo Tsen?
I'm afraid I cannot tell you.
One night, when the moonlight fell on Shangri-La, bathing the pavilion in a sea of blue...
I am sorry to disturb you at this hour, but I bring you important news.
Yes, Chang?
I congratulate you, sir. Tonight you are to be received by the High Lama.
As I followed Chang through the lamasery, I knew I was on the threshold of some great discovery. Pattering in front of me, he mounted a spiral staircase to a door which opened noiselessly before us. Chang left silently. As I became accustomed to the gloom, I saw sitting before me a small and wrinkled man. He was motionless, a faded antique portrait in Chinese dress, his face thin and drawn tight over the frame of his skull, and his eyes, I felt dizzy beneath the gaze of those ancient eyes.
You are Mr. Conway.
I am.
It is a pleasure to see you, Mr. Conway. Please sit down. I am an old man and can do no one any harm.
I feel it a great honor to be received by you.
Thank you. Chang tells me you have been asking many questions about our community and its affairs.
Oh, yes. I am very much interested.
The history of Shangri-La begins rightly in the city of Peking, in the year 1719. For it was then that four friars set out on a long and perilous journey by Lan Chao and Koko Noor. Three died on the way, and the fourth was not far from death when by accident he stumbled into the rocky defile that remains today the only practical approach to our Valley of the Blue Moon. There, to his joy and surprise, he found a friendly population who bade him welcome. Quickly he recovered his health and began to preach his mission. His name was Father Perrault. For more than half a century, Father Perrault labored with his hands like any other man, tilling his own garden and learning from the inhabitants as well as teaching them. Then, in the year 1789, news descended to the valley that Father Perrault was dying at last. He gathered his friends and servants round him and bade them all farewell. But the end was not yet. He lay for many weeks without speech or movement. and then he began to recover. He was then 108.
We continue with Act Two of Mary Pickford's favorite story, starring Ronald Colman as Hugh Conway in James Hilton's Lost Horizon.
The ancient lama paused, his eyes closed as if the discourse had tired him. What he had told me was not beyond belief, but as he went on, I was held speechless with wonder. It was 14 years later, he told me, that a wanderer found his way to Father Perrault's monastery, an Austrian named Henschel. A great friendship sprang up between the two, and Henschel stayed on. It was then they had a wild, fantastic dream. Art treasures from Europe and Asia were purchased with the valley's gold and stored at Shangri-La. The library was filled with all the great works of the world. And later it was decided to admit travelers and strangers who had lost their way.
In the years that followed, strangers did come. In 1910, Henschel died.
In 1910? But you said he came here in 1803.
There had been a quarrel about some porters. Henschel had just told one of our guests of the important proviso that governs their reception. Perhaps you are wondering, my dear Conway, what that proviso may be.
I think I can already guess. We are to stay here all of our lives.
And can you guess anything else?
Seems impossible. And yet, impossible as it may be, I know that it's the truth.
What is, my son?
That you are still alive, Father Perrault. It was almost beyond belief. The High Lama who sat beside me had lived for nearly 2.5 centuries. Our coming was no accident, he said. There had been no travelers to Shangri-La for 20 years. Many lamas had died. And our pilot had been sent out into the world to bring new life to the lamasery. Then there is death at Shangri-La.
Yes, my son. There are many of us who live no more than 100 years.
And if one of your lamas were to leave the Valley of the Blue Moon?
He would die. His years would fall on his shoulders like a great burden. And he would die very soon. An old, old man.
Lutzen.
You have seen the High Lama.
Lutzen, when did you come here? How long ago?
I was betrothed to a prince of Turkestan. We were traveling to Kashgar to meet him when my carriers lost their way in the mountains.
When did this happen?
In 1864. I was 18.
18? Then now you
are... The missionaries of Shangri-La found us. They brought us here. I never saw the man I was to marry.
Then in all these years, you have never known the meaning of love. Lutzen, is there no love at Shangri-La? Is there no room for love at Shangri-La, Lutzen? She didn't answer, but I saw a faint flush rising in her ivory cheek. And then I was aware that someone had entered the pavilion and was watching us. It was Mallinson. One night at midnight, I was summoned to the presence of the High Lama.
Tell me, my son, have you been happy at Shangri-La?
Quite happy, Father Perrault.
And what of Mr. Mallinson? Will he learn to be content also?
I'm afraid he's going to be a problem.
He's going to be your problem.
Why mine?
Because, my son, I am going to die.
You... Father Barrow.
Yes, we are all mortal, even here in the Valley of the Blue Moon. But I must feel at rest before I die. That is why I sent for you tonight.
You do me a great honor, Father.
I have waited for you, my son, for a long time. My son, there is a great storm gathering in the world, a black fury which will not spend itself for many years. It may rage till every flower of culture is trampled and all human things are leveled in vast chaos. But I believe that you will live through the storm. Beyond that, my vision weakens. But I see, at a great distance, a new world stirring in the ruins, seeking its lost and legendary treasures. And they will all be here, my son, hidden behind the mountains in the Valley of the Blue Moon. And you will be here to give them to the hopeful world. My son, I place in your hands the heritage and destiny of Shangri-La.
High Lama stopped speaking. The glow in his eyes faded. Presently it came to me as in a dream. The High Lama was dead.
Conway, I've been waiting for you. I say, what's the matter, Conway? Are you ill?
No, I'm just tired.
Well, pull yourself together, man. The porters are waiting for us.
The porters?
It's all arranged. They're going to take us back to Peshawar.
Yeah, but what?
I want to take Lode Sen out of this dreary place. Hurry, Conway, hurry.
But you can't. I'm
in love with Lode Sen, and she loves me. She's coming with us.
Lode Sen mustn't go. It's impossible.
Why? Why is it impossible?
Well, you must take my word for it. Lode Sen must never leave here.
Conway, the two of us can't manage the cliff. We must have your help. I want to get away from this place, and Lode Sen, too. She's young, doesn't she count?
Lode Sen is not young.
Not young? You're raving, man.
It's the truth. Her beauty is a fragile thing that can only live where fragile things are loved. Take her away from this valley, and she'll fade away like an echo. Malinson, listen to me. I tried then to tell him the secret of Shangri-La. He looked at me as though I were mad. And as I read the disbelief in his eyes, I began to doubt myself. It was too incredible even for me to believe. And then Lode Sen came to me.
You will help us, please. We need you.
Lode Sen, do you wish to leave Shangri-La?
Yes.
Well, you know, you understand the risk.
I love him. If he is not with me, I would die here.
For hours I paced the balcony. I couldn't tell whether I had been mad and was now sane, or had been sane for a time and was now mad again. But always before me were the wistful, pleading eyes of a little Manchu girl. And I knew that whatever was her fate, I must share in it. That morning, with the wind roaring through the jagged cliffs, we made the descent from Shangri-La. For weeks, we traveled toward the east, Malinson, the girl, and I. And then our porters began to desert. One by one, they disappeared, until there were just the three of us, creeping like snails across a desert wilderness. And then for a long time, we were only two. Malinson had died. At first, I tried to believe it was the hardship of our journey which had changed Lode Sen.
I am tired. I can go no further.
We must go on, Lode Sen.
I am tired.
There, look. Look, that must be the last range. That mountain. You see, Lode Sen?
It is too far. I cannot see so far.
One more step, Lode Sen. One more step. One more. One more.
No. You must go on alone from here.
Her eyes were depthless shadows, her skin drawn, the color of ancient parchment. Her cheekbones. Lutzen! Lutzen!
I am old. I am so old.
They found us on the road to Chungkyang, and we were taken to the hospital there. Lutzen, they told me later, Lutzen died that same night, the oldest woman they had ever seen. The storm of which Father Perrault warned me still rages. Not yet has the Christian ethic been fulfilled when the meek shall inherit the earth. But Shangri-La has a heritage to cherish and bequeath with such wisdom as men will need when their passions are spent. Soon, I hope, I will return. Somewhere beyond Lhasa, on the high roof of the world, I seem to picture a long plateau running north, and far away a mountain rising white against the sky. I hope to find it again, for this, I think, is Caracal. And beyond is Shangri-La and the Valley of the Blue Moon. Everyone was against her. Her family, the British government, and the man she hoped to marry. Yet she overcame these obstacles and 1,000 years of stubborn prejudice besides to become the heroine of modern medicine. Next week, we bring you the dramatic story of the Lady of the Lamp, Florence Nightingale, starring Miss Edna Best in the title role. We hope you'll be listening.
Not much is known about Europe Confidential. It was syndicated in the 1950s. Basil Rathbone was the host, and it was purported to be telling true stories of the world's greatest mysteries, founded on fact. The play today is The Silver Monkey.
Presenting The World's Greatest Mysteries. And now, your host.
This is Basil Rathbone. Once again, it's my pleasure to bring you an intriguing story of mystery. Today again, we have as our storyteller the young American newspaper man whose home is Paris and whose beat is Europe. Europe, a continent full of all the ingredients beloved by mystery writers and yet in reality twice as mysterious. Today's story is particularly full of suspense and yet is founded on fact. Of course, the names have been changed, but little else. There's a well-known saying that truth is stranger than fiction. Our story today is not only stranger, but more thrilling, more full of suspense than anything fiction can offer. Come with me, then, on another journey to the places where only a man in search of adventure would travel. In a moment, our play begins.
Presenting Europe Confidential.
Mr. Blake, I will be frank with you. There is much money invested in this race. If you were to win, it would prove an embarrassing.
Are you trying to threaten me?
As I said before, I come as a friend with some good advice.
And if I don't want it?
Then my conscience would be clear, and anything that happens to you would be your own fault.
Get out, Peppina, before I throw you out.
Very well, Mr. Blake, as you wish. But consider what I have said. Consider carefully. Otherwise, today's race could well be your last.
In a moment, we'll bring you Lionel Merton as Mike Conoy, the Paris correspondent of a famous American newspaper, in another exciting story in our series, Europe Confidential.
My name is Mike Conoy. I write a column called Europe Confidential for the Paris edition of a New York paper. One of the nicest spots I know in this part of the world is the town of Parlena in Italy. You've heard the name, of course. Parlena is where the big car race is held every August. Racing drivers from all over the world congregate there to risk their necks and their $30,000 racing cars for thrills, excitement, the honor, and a fat prize. And Mike Conoy goes, too, to lie in the sun, to drink good red wine, and, of course, to cover the race for the column. But who feels like work in a town like Parlena? The day before the big event, I wandered down to the pits in a half-hearted attempt to gather together a story or two from the drivers and their mechanics. And, as it sometimes happens, I met a guy I knew.
Well, if it isn't Mike Maloney.
Conoy, how are you, Rod?
Oh, Conoy, of course. Put it there, old man.
Long time no see, huh?
Yes, when was it? Le Mans, 1953.
Yeah, you came second, as I remember, but a close second. They tell me you're considered the favorite for tomorrow.
Yes, so they tell me.
It's a nice-looking car you've got, too.
Oh, it's a work special, none better. And Joe's got the engine absolutely humming. Oh, you haven't met, have you?
No, I don't think so.
Mike Conoy, meet Joe Binks, the finest nursemaid a car ever had.
All right.
Watch you, Mr. Conoy.
Hi, Joe. I guess I can quote you as saying you're confident of a win tomorrow.
Not half. The other cars just won't be in it. You won't see number 11 for dust, Mr. Conoy.
We hope.
Oh, come on, Chief. You're not still worrying about that flipping monkey, are you?
Monkey?
A flipping silver monkey on a piece of string.
Well, I still don't get it.
Well, laugh if you like, Mike, but I've lost my good luck charm.
Do I sense a story?
Oh, you'd better not, or I'd be the laughing stock of the racing world. But the fact remains that I've lost my talisman, or fetish, whatever you like to call it. And I feel darn uncomfortable about it.
Yeah, but surely all this business...
Hello, we got a visitor.
Vin Sicara.
The second favorite.
Yeah, that's right.
Good afternoon, Signor Blake.
Hello, Sicara. Trying out the track?
Just a practice run to stop me getting bored. I know every inch of the circuit. I know it like the back of my hand. I just thought I would inquire how things were with you.
Oh, excellent, thank you. Never better.
I hadn't seen you for a day or two.
Well, we've been occupied tuning up the engine. I never do much running about directly before a race. I like to save my energy.
Well, some may think it a good plan, but this circuit can be very treacherous one, Signor. It can be a killer to one who is unfamiliar with it.
Well, I've been over it several times. It didn't strike me as being terribly difficult.
It is a far different matter when you are actually racing, as you know. Two drivers I knew very well met their death here at Palermo.
Well, that's a risk we all take, Sicara, in any track, no matter how well we know it.
Yes, I suppose you are right. However, I felt it my duty to warn you, and now, Signor, I must go. And in case I don't see you before the race, good luck.
Thank you, Sicara. Same to you.
So that's the famous Nim Sicaro, huh?
Yes, my chief rival.
A nasty bit of work if ever there was one.
Well, pretty decent of him to warn you, though.
Was it? Well, possibly I'm hypersensitive, but it sounded to me more like a threat.
Threat?
Oh, I suppose it's just me. I got a nasty feeling about this race. And even the thought of £20,000 prize doesn't make me feel any happier.
And all because of a silver ruddy monkey.
Yeah, come on, give, Rod. What's this all about?
All right. Well, you see, when I was a lad, I used to race motorcycles. Half an hour before my first real race, I found a silver monkey lying in the dirt of the pit. I was probably off some girl's charm bracelet. Anyhow, as kids will, I picked it up, put it in my pocket, and decided there and then it would be my good luck charm. Well, I won the race. And after that, I never raced without it, even after I graduated to cars.
You believe that this piece of metal has some sort of magic about it?
No, of course I don't.
Well, then why all
this
nonsense?
Well, the charm, it gave me self-confidence. While it was hanging around my neck, I could take risks and know they'd pay off. You know, I could go that little bit faster. Take that bender, a fraction sharper.
Yeah, but if you realize that it was all in your own mind, why, there's nothing to worry about. If you could do it with that monkey, you could still do it without.
Oh, Mike, I'm afraid I can't. And for that reason, I'm going to pull out. I won't be racing tomorrow.
There was Rodney Blake, renowned the world over for his devil-may-care breakneck driving, refusing to race because he'd lost his talisman. Can you beat it? Personally, I've no time whatsoever for this superstitious nonsense. I've walked under ladders, spilt salt by the cellar full, broken mirrors galore, and so far nothing's ever happened to me. Or has it? Well, Joe and I gave him a talking to. We tried to make him see reason. At the end of half an hour, we'd almost succeeded.
I suppose you're right. At least I know you're right. I'd be a darn fool to pull over. But even so,
If you didn't race tomorrow and the reason got around, as these things do, why, you'd never live it down, Chief.
But at least I'd be alive.
Look, isn't there an easier way out of this?
Well, like what?
Well, let's look for the monkey. Where do you think you lost it?
That's the trouble. I don't know. You see, I usually wear it around my neck, but yesterday morning I noticed it was gone.
We've looked everywhere for it.
My wife's turned the hotel suite upside down. There's no sign of it.
So the sensible thing to do is to forget you ever had a flipping talisman.
Or get a new one.
But whatever happens, Chief, you've got to race tomorrow. Tell yourself you've lost your nerve, and sure as eggs is eggs, you will lose it.
Well, I won't make any promises, Joe. I'll see how I feel about it tomorrow. And Mike, do me a favor. Nothing about this in your column, huh?
Oh, I don't write a word, much as I'd like to. By the way, why don't you and your wife have dinner with me tonight?
I'll have to, Mike. But I insist, you dine with us.
Well, okay, then. Either way suits me.
Well, we're staying at the Hotel Napoli, suite 206. About, 8 o'clock?
I'd never met Rod's wife before, but Janet Blake was a honey. She had the kind of blonde hair you can't get from a bottle. A pair of wide blue eyes and more curves than a scenic railway. She was very concerned about her husband's welfare.
No, Rod, I don't want you to race tomorrow, and that's final. If you drive feeling that you're going to have an accident, chances are you will. And I don't want to be a widow, darling.
Just as I talked him into it.
I seem to be getting just more confused. One part of me says £20,000 prize money, and boy, do you need it. And the other part of me says the only thing you'll win is a broken neck.
Oh, we don't need the money all that badly, darling.
Don't we? Have you seen my bank balance lately? Janet, are you sure you look everywhere?
I've done everything but tear the carpets up. I've mentioned it to the hotel staff, told them we'll pay a reward, but no luck.
I wish I'd never found that darn thing in the first place.
Well, if you hadn't, you probably would have placed your faith in something else. A lucky shilling, lock to your mother's hair, a rabbit's foot. You know, and the funny part is that anything can give you confidence, just so long as you believe in it.
You know, I've never thought of it that way.
Another cup of coffee, Mr. Canoy?
Yeah, no, thanks, Mrs. Blake. I've done very nicely. You know, a fellow I once knew started a Lucky Charms by post business. You fill in the coupon, post it off with a dollar bill, and he sends you a genuine lucky pixie stone by return mail. All his advertisements began with the same caption, The lucky pixie stone brought me a wealth of good fortune, and believe me, it did. He used to sell 50,000 of these things every year, and it was all profit.
Oh, dear, look at the time. As I explained to you before, Mr. Canoy, I have to go out for a while. You will excuse me, won't you?
Well, of course, Mrs. Blake.
I promised Helen I'd have a drink with her tonight. Helen Jorgensen, you know, the wife of the Swedish driver.
Yeah, I've heard the name.
Ah, now, where did I leave my purse and gloves?
Here, right in front of your nose.
Oh, thank you, darling.
Hey, careful.
Oh, that was clumsy of me.
Here, let me help you pick it up.
No, thank you, darling. It's all right.
I don't know where you find the most odds and ends, in a man's pockets or a woman's purse.
There, and now I must rush. Goodbye, Mr. Canoy. It's been so nice meeting you. Perhaps we'll see you tomorrow. We can watch the race together, all three of us.
Yes. Good night, Mrs. Blake.
Bye, darling. Be back in an hour or so.
All right, Pet.
And don't let Mr. Canoy talk you into anything. I'd rather have a live husband than a dead one.
Well, I suppose that settles it. I don't race tomorrow. The decision's been taken from me, and I'm glad.
Yeah. Rod, will you pardon me if I leave now? I just suddenly remembered I'm supposed to phone my editor in Paris with some sort of a story.
Oh, you can do it from here if you like.
Well, thanks. No, I've got to write it out first, so I better go back to my hotel. Anyhow, thanks for having me. I'll see you tomorrow sometime. My excuse sounded pretty weak, I know, but I wanted to get out in a hurry. I was puzzled about Rod's wife. You see, when Janet dropped her purse and spilt the contents on the floor, I saw her hand close on something and shove it quickly out of sight. You'd never guess what it was. Yeah, a silver monkey on a piece of string. When I came out of the hotel, Janet was way down the street, almost out of sight in the dark and walking fast. I followed. After 15 minutes, she stopped outside a three-story apartment house. I watched without any qualms. She pressed a dainty finger on the bell, and who should open the door and take her in his arms but Nim Sicaro? Dear Dorothy Dix, when a guy discovers that an acquaintance's wife is being unfaithful, what should he do? Me, I decided to shut up about it, for the time being at least. However, next morning, first thing, I dropped into a jeweler's shop and made myself a small purchase. That done, I went down to the pits and presented my small purchase to Rod Blake. Have you ever seen a racing driver jump for joy?
Mike, old boy, it's it. It's the monkey.
Yeah.
Joe, come here, look.
What's up, Chief?
He's found my monkey.
Well, I'll be...
What wonderful luck.
Oh, I thought you said you'd look for it.
But so he did.
I found it not 30 feet from here, lying in the dust.
Oh, I don't know how to thank you, Mike. You're just in time. I was about to hand my withdrawal into the Chief Steward. Now this changes everything.
So you'll be racing after all.
By Jiminy, I will be.
Ah, that's what I like.
Oh, excuse me a moment, Mike. I'll get Janet on the phone. Is she going to be pleased?
As the time for the race drew nearer, Rod and his team of mechanics fussed around the car like a bunch of happy kids on Christmas morning. It was 12 noon, and Rod and I were sipping a cup of steaming coffee when we had a visitor.
Excuse me, is Mr. Blake here?
I'm Blake. Can I help you?
My name is Pepe Papina. You have heard the name, no?
Yes, sir. I believe I have.
Excellent. I wonder if you and I could have a few words alone. I'm sure this gentleman will excuse us.
Oh, sure.
Wait on, Mike. A few words about what?
I would prefer to tell you alone, Mr. Blake. You see, it is something rather personal. He got the race.
You can say it in front of my companion.
Very well. First, Mr. Blake, let me say that I come as a friend, as you possibly know. I and many of my acquaintances make our living from speculation.
Pepina, of course. This guy's one of the biggest gamblers in Europe.
Thank you. Mr. Blake, there is much money invested in the race this afternoon.
And?
Frankly, Mr. Blake, it would be embarrassing were you to win. Knowing how ruthless my colleagues can be, I felt it was my duty to come here today and warn.
Are you trying to threaten me?
Not at all, Mr. Blake. It is not I who threaten. Why, that would be a criminal offense, would it not? I come here simply as a friend with some good advice.
And if I don't want it?
Then my conscience is clear. And anything that should happen to you would be your own fault.
Get out of here, Peppino, or I'll personally throw you out.
Very well, Mr. Blake, as you wish. But consider what I have said. Consider it. Careful.
Phone the police, Rod. Let them take care of it.
Police, what could they do?
Well, arrest him. You've got me as a witness.
Arrest him for what? Giving me some advice?
No, he couldn't do anything. Anyhow, it's only a bluff.
Well, I'm not so sure.
They wouldn't be game. Besides, what could happen to me? I'll be wearing my silver monkey.
One 1:30 p.m. In 30 minutes, the race was due to begin. I wished Rod all the best and then went to see the chief steward. I told him my story and then made a rather unusual request of him.
But, Mr. Conroy, nothing like this has ever been done before.
I know.
But if what you say is true...
I assure you it is.
We should put the matter in the hands of the police. But as you say, what could they do? It would mean, among other things, a postponement of the race.
Believe me, what I suggest is the only way.
Very well, Mr. Conroy. In the interests of fair play, I will do it. Menko, come here, quickly.
I walked back through the crowd until I was in a position where I could see the entrance to the pits. The cars were being driven slowly into their starting positions along the track. A car with number 3 emerged. It was Nim Sakaro. Then a few moments later, the other car came out. Number 11, Rod Blake. I could see Rod waving goodbye to Janet. I waited no longer. I walked to the back entrance to the pits and stood in the crowd. A few seconds later, Janet Blake hurried out, and I followed her. I didn't even see the start of the race. All I heard was a scream of engines and a roar from the crowd. I was busy trailing Janet Blake for the second time in 24 hours. She was walking towards the west end of the track, some 2 miles away. There were hardly any spectators up this end, hardly anybody except Janet trudging through the long grass and me following. She disappeared over a small hill. I walked to the top and found myself peering into the wrong end of a 30-30 rifle. It was Pepe Pepina.
Put up your hands.
Surprise, surprise, Mr. Conroy.
Oh, not so much of a surprise, Mrs. Blake. I guessed who you were going to meet. You see, I saw you and Sicaro last night.
Frustrated detective, are you, Conroy? But you wouldn't have made a very good one. I've known you were following me for the last 10 minutes.
Here, I gag him with my handkerchief. And tie his hands with his cord.
With pleasure.
Now, look, wait a minute.
I will not hesitate to shoot.
Look, there's something you ought to know. You see, I...
There we are.
For your breath, my friend. Walk over there where I can watch you. Sit down. That's it.
You saw the monkey in my bag last night, Conroy, didn't you? I thought I got it out of sight in time, but apparently I didn't. Yes, you're right. I stole it in an attempt to stop Rodney racing today. And it would have worked if you hadn't given him that phony one this morning. I know you can buy them easily enough. Now we may have to cause an accident, and it'll be all your doing.
Well, there he goes. Number 11.
And there's Nim, right behind him.
24 more laps to go.
And if dear Rodney's still leading on the last lap, he'll have the smash of his life. And all the good luck charms in the world won't save him.
What could I do but watch? As the race went on, the two cars in question held their lead. Pepina, from his vantage point, had a perfect view of the sharp turn at the end of the track. The cars had to slow down to negotiate it. As the two cars neared the turn on the last lap, Pepina lay down on the grass and pushed the stock of the rifle against his shoulder.
Which one's leading? Can you see?
They think it's
Yes, a number 11.
Rodney, the fool.
The fool, indeed.
Pepe, please be careful.
Don't. I am aiming for the tire, not the man.
The car zigzagged along the track as the driver fought to regain control, but Pepina's bullet had done its job. The car veered into the safety fence with a sickening crash and burst into flame. At that moment, half a dozen uniformed police appeared over the brow of the hill. Pepina grabbed Janet's arm and they tried to make a run for it, but they didn't get too far. By the time somebody had released my bonds, the pair were being led back, handcuffed to a pair of tough-looking cuffs. An ambulance had reached the burning car. I'm afraid they were too late.
I didn't have anything to do with it. He fired the shot.
I would advise you to leave the accusations until later, Signora.
We did not mean to kill him.
Nevertheless, Nim Sicaro is dead.
Nim? No, you're making a mistake. He's in car 3.
No, Signora. At the last minute, the stewards had the numbers of the two cars changed. Number 3 became a number 11, and number 11 became a number 3. That is Nim Sicaro who lies dead in that car, not your husband.
Give it to me straight, Mike. Right from the beginning.
Okay. Janet and Nim Sicaro planned to run off together right after the race today. Sicaro introduced her to Pepina, and the three of them put their heads together. They decided they would back Sicaro for a fortune, and Janet's job was to stop you from racing.
Go on.
So she stole the monkey, knowing how much you depended on it. By this morning, when I handed you the fake monkey, they knew they'd have to try something else. Pepina came and tried to warn you off, but you weren't having any. So he and Janet decided that rather than lose all that dough, they'd shoot a tire if you were leading and put you out of the race.
And you saw the chief steward and asked him to change the numbering?
Well, it was the only way. I had no idea exactly what they were going to do, but
why did Sicaro try to win if he knew they were waiting to shoot number 11?
Yeah, that's just it. He didn't know. Janet thought he would have been against it, so she didn't tell him. The police arrived a fraction of a second too late. Unknown to me, the chief steward rang the police immediately I left, had me followed. But they lost sight of me as I was following Janet, and by the time they found us...
I see. Well, Mike, thanks for saving my life.
Rod, I'm sorry about Janet.
Yes, Sergeant. I can still hardly believe it. I suppose you never can tell with a woman. I'll get over it, I expect. In time.
He did get over it, but it took a long, long time. Matter of fact, I saw Rod again last week at Le Mans. He won the Grand Prix. He told me after the race that he knew he couldn't lose. He was carrying a four-leafed clover.
You have been listening to Lionel Merton as Mike Conoy in another exciting episode in the series, Europe Confidential.
This is Basil Rathbone again, and so our journey into the realms of mystery is over. Soon, however, I'll be back with more of these tales of mystery, which I know we all enjoy so much. Well, goodbye now till we meet again to listen to another of the world's greatest mysteries. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. We'll be back next time. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.